Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Chris Siderick. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, with the 2020 field flocking to New Hampshire this week, how has the state's role changed this primary season?
There's no question that the New Hampshire primary is sharing its power, not just with cable news and the DNC, but nationwide.
Also today, can we stop the next mass shooting? A Worcester researcher working with the FBI says it's possible.
If we look closely enough, and if people are confident enough to say, I'm actually concerned about somebody and actually concerned about them being violent, they can do something about it.
And the ongoing fallout of a major police sweep in the South End.
I asked the city of Boston why all of a sudden they took notice recently. That's the challenge I put to the city of Boston. This has been going on for years. Where have they been?
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Chris Siderick. If you've ever wanted to meet a presidential candidate, to paraphrase author Horace Greeley, go north, young folks. At least 10 candidates, including President Trump himself, are in or will be in New Hampshire this week. Here's Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders at a town hall event in Berlin this morning.
I am the only candidate running for president who will tell you a simple truth that you're not going to see on TV or read in the papers. And that simple truth is that no president, not Bernie Sanders or anybody else, can do it alone. Can't do it alone, because we are taking on enormous power in the corporate elite.
A familiar message from Sanders, but is it one that's still resonating with New Hampshire voters? To answer that and to take a deeper look at the candidates in the Granite State, we turn to James Pindle, political reporter for the Boston Globe. James, how's it going?
Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, thanks for being here. So we saw last week everyone's soapbox speeches at the Iowa State Fair. Now this week, everybody's coming to New Hampshire, it feels like. How common is it to see trips in bunches like this where you have almost half the field basically descending on New Hampshire?
Well, it does come in fits and starts. I think it's important to remember that while Bernie Sanders is spending 2 days in the state, for example, he has not been here or been to New Hampshire in 8 weeks. Not 8 weeks, but since June. So there's been fits and starts. There's also been – it's more complicated for candidates running for president this time. You know, Chris, I've spent my entire life on the Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primary.
Right.
Well over 20 years doing it, and you get a sense of the rhythm and how things generally work. And I got to tell you, this primary just feels different in terms of how it's playing out.
Yeah, it seems that the campaigns have a bit of a different approach. I want to stick with Sanders specifically for just a minute. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren is in town tomorrow. Sanders is up there yesterday. He's talking about standing up to the corporate elite. We know he won the New Hampshire primary in 2016 with more than 60% of the vote. It's been tougher for him to gain traction this time around. You're up covering the New Hampshire campaigns. Is he still connecting with New Hampshire voters in the same way?
Well, sure. I mean, I think it's important to remember he is in second place. And another important thing to remember, I was with him last night. And the math of the primary this time, you know, is very important. You know, you mentioned he got 60% of the vote. If he just retains half of that vote, he's going to win the next New Hampshire primary. So while many campaigns are trying to build their support, he's just trying to retain that support. But yes, the burn, the energy, the enthusiasm is not the same as it was the first time, but he is still very much in the hunt.
Yeah, to that point, after the first debate, his campaign, it felt like, had a bit of a shakeup where they decided, okay, this message isn't resonating anymore, and they decided to go all in basically on the Medicare for All plan. I want to play a little clip of Sanders speaking about that this morning.
That's what the American people want, and we've come a long way in 4 years, poll after poll after poll. Says that if you ask the American people, do you want to expand Medicare to cover everybody, freedom of choice, doctor, hospital, no copayments, no deductibles, no out-of-pocket expenses, the American people overwhelmingly say yes.
So Sanders' campaign has kind of shifted focus to really use that as one of their trademark issues. Do you feel like that's a winning strategy in New Hampshire?
Well, look, I think if anything, they have disciplined the message around that one big idea. I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, but it does remind me, and I was thinking this last night watching him, this does remind me somewhat of how Donald Trump used the wall last time. It's not that other Republican candidates didn't support the concept of a wall or tightening the border. But he had a signature issue that played really well with his base, and he owned it, and he talked about it every single time. Bernie Sanders can talk about many different issues. His campaign last time was about a revolution, climate change. He can talk about any number of issues, but right now he spends the bulk of his time talking about Medicare for All. And again, other candidates agree with him to some point. They have different plans, but he is certainly trying to put his stake in the ground on that one issue.
There is a key distinction there, though, I would say, that Senator Sanders actually has written legislation for Medicare for All as opposed to the wall as kind of a nebulous concept.
And the Mexicans are going to pay for the wall, and apparently right. Americans will pay for Medicare for All. That was my snarky joke of the day.
I see. So according to – you actually mentioned that Senator Sanders has not spent a ton of time in New Hampshire, 538 – ran the numbers and found that he spent about 4% of his campaign days in the Granite State through the end of July. Do you think he's doing enough there to maintain that support you're talking about?
Well, look, I mean, when I tried to say a little bit earlier that the primary has changed in the sense that, look, I think before we used to cover this campaign using metrics like visits, how much staff or and how much organization in terms of endorsements that they're going to get in terms of, you know, do they have momentum? You know, these days we are using different metrics. We're using national polling, which personally is offensive because that's not where the campaign is playing out. You can ask a person in New York State or, you know, 1 out of 12 Americans live in California, and that's not where the campaign is playing out. So I don't know why we're asking their opinion, but we are in these national polls. We're using those metrics. Small dollar contributions are metrics. And so in that sense, Bernie Sanders, who has the most small dollar contributions of any candidate in the race, and the DNC thinks that metric matters, he is certainly winning the campaign on that particular element. And that has absolutely, well, very little to do with how many trips he makes to New Hampshire.
This may require a bit of speculation on your part, but there's always been kind of a threshold where you expect candidates need to do well in early states, Iowa, New Hampshire, maybe South Carolina, in order to show they have a viable candidacy. Do you think that that's still the case?
Yes. So you have to look at this campaign in different phases. I've been concerned as a person who deeply loves the tradition of Iowa and New Hampshire. Obviously, I told you my background. I believe in the notion that at some place and at some time, a person who's about to make decisions on who wins or loses in the tax code or who goes to war and whose families are impacted, that these folks who live in rarefied circles, senators, business leaders, governors, should have to engage in talk back and forth with everyday people, even if it's just for 4 or 5 months. I think that's a very important part of the process. But we have not seen that part of the process really play out the same way we have in, say, the last four decades, just because of the increase in the incentives in the system to get on cable news, to try to increase your fundraising base and travel around to different states, as the New York Times is really well documented how many states are involved now. And there's a good process for democracy in that. I'm not hitting that. I'm saying we lost that process. But that's in the early stage. I think later on, there's no doubt that we may have, you know, 9, 7, 8, 9, 10 candidates heading into the Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primary. And if you do not do well in those states, I don't see how you have any momentum to head to what is going to be a topic of many shows down the line, which is Super Duper Duper Tuesday, which is going to be California and Texas and a whole and Massachusetts and a whole host of states. And if you don't come into those states with momentum, I don't know how this is ever going to work for you. You literally cannot raise enough money to fight against it.
Yeah. So you mentioned the money. You mentioned the national polls. We're in this kind of interesting moment politically where to get to that 7, 8, 9 candidates, the Democratic field has to be cut in more than half. And that may happen in this next round of debates. The DNC has tightened the restrictions in order to qualify for the stage. You said that national polls, that it's concerning to use those for you. What do you make of this idea of the debate stage as kind of a cutoff for who's a viable candidate?
Well, look, I mean, you talk to even folks in Iowa and New Hampshire in the last two polls. We had Suffolk University Globe poll last week, and there's a Des Moines Register poll last month, and both of them said even folks in these early states really want this field cut down.
Right.
They want to get on with their choices. I think we also are seeing a natural winnowing of the process long before the DNC. I mean, we have a couple, maybe four, five, possibly six front runners, depending on how you want to define that. And then we have 20 other people who are lingering out at 0 or 1%. And the DNC is pretty much making it hard for those folks to make it to the next stage. You talk about the next debate. I mean, we're talking about the next deadline is August 28th. So we're really a couple weeks to when these candidates really have to make some tough decisions. At the end of the day, these candidates are working to meet those metrics from the DNC, and they're not out talking about their particular ideas. For example, the game now is to not have your best plan for rural communities. It's not have your best plan for healthcare. It's how are you going to spend $70 to $100 grabbing $1 and a donation on a Facebook ad. That is the game right now. That in trying to get on Rachel Maddow or whatever else in terms of a national cable platform.
Yeah. One of the candidates who's fighting that uphill battle that you're talking about is Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton. He said that his campaign has said that he's more focused on the New Hampshire primary than worrying about qualifying for the debates. That may be because he's been left off. But he's taking an interesting strategy. As you put it, he's telling New Hampshire voters what they're doing wrong. Can you tell us a little bit more about his strategy and what you make of it?
Well, it was a strategy, to be fair. It just really caught me when I was watching him yesterday. Part of his stump speech was not in an inconsistent way, but just here and there, he would start to kind of slam New Hampshire sort of way of life, highway liquor stores, for example. So I had a little fun and said, well, let's play rapid fire on some other New Hampshire traditions. And he played along, and good for him. But he's just trying to get noticed. He was very – you go to a Bernie Sanders event like I did yesterday. You had one event, you had 350 people. The next event, he had 400. Seth Moulton went to an event that had a built-in audience because it was a chamber of commerce that had 36 people. So just to put that in context where we're at, this is really a campaign right now of the haves and have-nots, and that's part of the natural process.
Yeah, one of the candidates in the 2020 election who doesn't have to try to be noticed is President Trump. He'll host a rally Thursday in Manchester at Southern New Hampshire University Arena. A crowd of potentially 12,000, maybe more. Interesting, because you talked about on the ground meeting voters. We see a lot of intimate town hall events in New Hampshire. This is a different style. It's a style he really kind of introduced and owned in the 2016 campaign. What do you make of its effectiveness, and do you think it could change how candidates campaign?
Well, he already has. I mean, we can talk about this year feeling so much different, but we've been on a slide of where this notion of Jimmy Carter or Gary Hart knocking on doors, spending the night in people's houses and meeting people at coffee shops and having intimate house parties. You know, the last New Hampshire primary had two huge winners, or huge, to use both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders' word, where Bernie Sanders won by 22 points, Donald Trump won by 20 points, and neither one really did a retail sort of campaign.
Right.
So they did the big rallies that really showed the momentum and support. And so this is pretty much an offshoot of how Donald Trump has always campaigned, particularly how he's always campaigned in New Hampshire. In fact, he said he didn't really want to spend much time on the ground when he ran last time, and he didn't. He didn't have much of a ground game. But again, he had a lot of people knew where he stood. Obviously, he may just be a total anomaly of all of American politics, or he may be the harbinger of the future.
All right. Last question. You've talked to a lot of New Hampshire voters as you've been covering these candidates. What's it going to take from candidates to connect with these voters? What are the real priorities you're sensing?
Have two different things. You have people want to connect with you on a personal level. This is New Hampshire. What traditions are there? That's very much true. They want to agree with you on issues. They hear where you stand on issues. But on the back of their mind, whether it's gun violence they talk about in schools, or it's going to be healthcare, or the economy, whatever issue it is, they still want to know. How are you going to beat Trump? This is Democratic audiences, and every candidate has to answer that question in their own way.
All right. That's James Pindle, political reporter for the Boston Globe. James, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, can we stop the next mass shooting? One Worcester researcher says there is hope. I'm Chris Sidorek. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
We know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717. 917-417-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Chris Siderick. When a mass shooting occurs, like we saw in Dayton and El Paso just over a week ago, we're all left wondering the same things. Why? And how do we prevent the next tragedy? Here to help shine at least some light on that is James Silver, assistant professor of criminal justice at Worcester State University. He's the co-author of a 2018 study for the FBI titled A Study of the Pre-Attack Behaviors of Active Shooters in the United States between 2000 and 2013. Professor Silver, welcome to Radio Boston.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me, Chris. I appreciate it.
So for this study, you looked at 160 active shooter incidents in the U.S. between 2000 and 2013, 63 individual shooters. What were the commonalities you found about who the shooters were?
Well, first of all, we actually only looked at 63 events. The FBI originally studied 160 of these shooting events, these active shooting events. And we actually took what we call a deep dive into 63 of them. So the commonalities we found were, frankly, not that encouraging in terms of what everyone wants, which is, can we predict this?
Right.
So what we found is they're overwhelmingly male, which is, I don't think, surprising to too many people. But that's not really very specific when it comes to trying to predict these things. So you say men, great, age range. Just in our study alone, our youngest shooter was 12. The older shooter was 88. So we're basically talking about every post-pubescent male in America.
So was there anything about the shooters that gave you a hint of why?
The why is a very complicated question. What we found is that in this study and in other studies that are related to this about mass shooters, there's normally what we call a grievance. Now, a grievance is maybe not what it means in common parlance. We mean something more than just being angry, right? This isn't just a little bit of road rage or I'm mad at a coworker. A grievance is something that's sort of like we refer to as sort of a wound that won't heal. It's a sense that you've been wronged in this world. There's an injustice and you need to correct it. And so it becomes sort of an organizing principle for these folks. And what we find is almost all of them have some grievance. What that grievance is really varies. It can be something as mundane as I'm being treated unfairly at work. It could be racially based. It could be misogyny. There's just so many different reasons that go into a grievance.
Yeah, and you were actually quoted in a New York Times article talking about the role of misogyny in mass shootings. Would you say that's just one component and it's more complicated than that, it sounds like?
I would. I would say it's definitely more complicated than that. And misogyny is certainly something that's come up in mass shootings recently, but it's also come up in mass shootings over the past 30 or 40 years. So it's nothing new. It's become noticed now. But there's other things that have gone into mass shootings like hate crimes, like just anger at a neighbor. Sometimes there's mental health issues. And I think what we would say from this report and other research I've done is probably almost every one of these shootings is what we would call multifactorial. There's a bunch of different threads that go into forming a grievance.
So you mentioned mental health there. That is very commonly one of the things that is sparked in the public conversation after incidents like we saw in Dayton and El Paso. What role did you find mental health played?
So in the 63 shooters that we looked at, we could only identify 25% had a diagnosed mental illness before the shooting. That sounds like a pretty high number. But
I thought it was kind of low, actually, when I saw that.
Well, that's great. That's an interesting take on it. So a lot of people, I guess, do think that mental illness drives almost all of this. And that's just not the case. So we found 25% had a diagnosed mental illness. Of course, there could be underlying mental illnesses that aren't diagnosed because people don't go for care, care isn't accessible, whatever that might be. It's important to recognize, too, the lifetime prevalence of mental illness in adults in the United States is around 50%. So the fact that many of these people have either diagnosed mental illness or maybe those around them saying they showed signs of mental illness really shouldn't be surprising. That's about half the adults in the U.S. It's unlikely, at least from the studies I've done, this FBI study among others, that mental illness is the driving factor, the master explanation for most of these active shooting incidents.
One of the other issues I think that commonly enters public conversation after these incidents is gun control. Mm-hmm. I was struck by looking through your research that the vast majority of guns used in these incidents were legally purchased. 40%, the biggest portion, were bought with the explicit purpose of carrying out the shooting. And then another 35% of the shooters already owned the weapons. What did you make of that?
It's very interesting to understand that most of these mass shooters or active shooters are probably not prohibited by at least federal law from purchasing a gun if they want to. Most of them don't have a mental illness that has made them involuntarily committed. Most of them did not have the type of disqualifying criminal records that would keep them from buying a gun. So most of them can just buy a gun.
But that feels right, like a real failure on our part, if that is the case.
It may be a failure. It is a reality, though. It is true that they can buy them. I did another study of 115 mass murderers, and those are people who killed at least four people in one incident. And only 4% of them would have been prohibited from legally purchasing a gun if they bought it just for the purpose of the attack they eventually carried out.
4%?
4%. Most of them had the gun already or just went out and legally purchased it. Some did borrow it / stole it from a friend. But access to guns is a very difficult issue, and it's hard to keep the people who do these shootings from getting guns because they don't have the backgrounds that you might think they do. They're not delusional or psychotic, and they don't have serious criminal records.
So we're going to come back to that aspect, but I want to ask about how these shooters behaved before an attack, because that's one of the things that you were really driving at with the report.
What we found is there's a large number of warning signals. Now, I want to be clear, in this report we talked about this, and in other studies I've talked about this. We're not saying we're blaming anybody for not bringing a person to the attention of law enforcement. This isn't about blame or responsibility. But in looking at these shooters, we found that they do have many warning signs. We were able to find, you know, 3 to 5 warning signs or concerning behaviors per individual.
Can you give us an example of what those
are? Sure. A very common thing is what we in sort of the threat assessment and criminology field call behavioral leakage. This is a person indicating that they're going to do harm to another person. They're going to attack somebody. They're going to kill somebody. They'll say it in a blog. They'll talk about it with friends. It may not be something even that direct, but it could be a threat. If I get fired, I'm coming back. You know I've got guns. It's really quite amazing how often people will tell others around them what they're going to do. So it's probably human nature to disregard it, to try and downplay that, to not think the worst of the person you hear it from. But overwhelmingly, in school shootings, workplace shootings, all types of public shootings, people have actually said what they were going to do and then did it. So what we found is that and other types of warning behaviors, like a sudden fascination with guns, increased anger levels that are just disproportionate to the situations, are the types of things that could be noticed. We call them observable behaviors, and they can be seen. What we hope is that if people see them, they might take them seriously enough to report them to law enforcement.
Yeah, so that was kind of your big underlying point here, is that you would encourage folks, if they are close to someone that is exhibiting these behaviors, to report them to law enforcement or to what's
probably
the solution?
It's probably going to be law enforcement, right? That's who people would know to go to. I think it's important, though, that people understand if you report somebody because they have this concerning behavior, the person you're reporting probably hasn't committed a crime yet. So law enforcement, if they do what is, I think, a best practice, use a threat assessment approach, they will be more interested in problem solving for the person of concern and less interested in punishment delivery. So it's really about saying, can we help this person? Because they seem to be heading towards a very tragic end, and let's move them off this pathway to violence.
So this is where I want to come back to the access to guns, because if you look at the El Paso incident, the mother of the shooter did that, talked to law enforcement, said, I am concerned over the weapon that my son owns. And there wasn't anything they could do. He was legally able to own that weapon.
Which is really – that's a great question, because that gets right to what I want to talk about, which is threat assessment. So what happened in that case – and this is just from my reading of reports, so I don't really know for sure. But the police said he has not committed a crime yet. And that's true. You can't go arrest somebody for legally owning a gun. Had those police officers or that law enforcement agency used a threat assessment approach, they might have said, okay, the person hasn't committed a crime, but can we do something to intervene because somebody is clearly concerned? A threat assessment team would be ideally done, would have law enforcement professionals, mental health professionals, social workers, and of course, depending on the setting, if it's a university, maybe, you know, human resources people, academics, whatever. But the idea would be intervene, help the person, and don't wait till there is a reason to arrest. So had that model been used, perhaps that incident could have been averted. Although clearly, again, not blaming anybody, that law enforcement agency or that mother.
Right.
There's no perfect, but an approach that looked at it as a problem to be solved and not a crime to be prevented might have been helpful.
So, but does that include a higher standard for gun ownership?
I'm not sure it includes a higher standard for gun ownership. I do think it would lead to the idea that a threat assessment team might go, if a state has a red flag law, and be able to say, we'd like to temporarily take a gun away from this person. And that would have to be done with all due process rights and everything else that goes along with that. So it would be on an individual basis. We're not trying to predict people who are going to be violent. We're saying this person appears, but based on their behavior, to be heading towards violence. And might we be able to intervene with a red flag law? Yes.
Okay. So at the other side of that, when you're talking about reporting to law enforcement, there are communities that don't feel comfortable, maybe immigrants without documentation, or I'm thinking of minority communities with all the police shootings. In 2015, we had a police shooting of Osama Rahim here in Boston. Family reached out. I mean, there are serious concerns with reaching out to law enforcement that things could escalate because of that.
I think that's obviously a risk, right? That's true. And there's not a perfect answer to that. But if a threat assessment team in a community included law enforcement, but also included, as I said, social workers, could be religious leaders, mental health practitioners. The idea would be spread the word that threat assessment is not about arrest and prosecution. That may be a result, and that's always a risk, right? But the idea would be, can we provide services? So, for example, Virginia is a state that, for obvious reasons, has mandated threat assessment teams in its schools, universities, high schools, and middle schools. It's used widely. Hundreds to thousands of people are reported. Students are reported every year. The vast majority of them stay in school. They're not suspended, expelled, or prosecuted. And the primary response is providing services. If that model were used elsewhere in the country, I would hope that people would feel more comfortable reporting it because it's less law enforcement and more problem solving.
Do you think or worry at all about the – once you start talking about, okay, watching and reporting each other, the Big Brother aspect, the idea that we're all kind of monitoring each other and the thought police basically, is that something you think about?
Absolutely. That's a very good question, and of course that's a concern. I would say this. I would like to move away from the idea of it being the thought police because, again, this is based on behaviors. And I suppose if you're making threats and saying wild things that's thinking, but it's also behavior, right? So it would be behavior-based. It's also community-based. You're right. We're asking people to watch out for each other. I would like to think that people would do that anyway. And again, if it's about watching each other so we can provide help to those in need and less about persecuting and prosecuting those we don't like, I think the model could be successful. But what you raise is a clear risk and something that needs to be handled carefully and judiciously.
I'm wondering, I think some folks might see, okay, this is a report authored for the FBI. It's advocating for expansion of law enforcement resources. Is there an inherent conflict of interest there?
That's also a very good point. And I'd like to say that the findings in that report are echoed in many other research done by private entities, other research I've done, other research that my colleagues in this field have done. So the idea of using threat assessment and trying to make it more of a national model does come in part from law enforcement, but I think it comes just from good research and the outcomes that we found in privately funded or non-law enforcement funded research.
I just want to note, I misspoke earlier. Osama Rahim's family, as far as we know, did not reach out to law enforcement. I was just trying to use that as an example of how things can escalate quickly. So I think we can all agree that we want to stop or at least curtail these mass shootings. So how do we – it's such a divisive issue. Anytime this type of thing happens, we see everybody runs to their political corners. How do we come together and actually change the culture on this?
I'd like to think that the threat assessment approach is one way to do that because, again, what we're talking about is we're not saying there's a class of people who can't own weapons or a class of people who should be afraid to own weapons or we should be afraid of. What we're saying is individual people at different points in their lives have stresses, have responses that are violent, and those people we should be able to help if we can. We may not be able to. Obviously, we won't find everybody. But this is more of a providing of services to individuals who've shown us that they're a threat. And so I would hope that it's not seen as a big brother approach to monitoring everybody, and it's not necessarily a gun control approach. It's a providing services approach.
That's James Silver, Assistant Professor of Criminal Justice at Worcester State University. He's the co-author of a 2018 study for the FBI titled A Study of the Pre-Attack Behaviors of Active Shooters in the United States Between 2000 and 2013. Professor Silver, thanks so much for coming in.
You're welcome. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, the ongoing fallout after a major police sweep in the South End. We'll hear from community members and take your calls. I'm Chris Siderick. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Chris Siderick.
I asked the city of Boston why all of a sudden they took notice recently. That's the challenge I put to the city of Boston. This has been going on for years. Where have they been?
That's South End resident Jonathan Alvis speaking at a community meeting last week. That meeting came after a tumultuous week in the neighborhood. First, an attack on a Suffolk County House of Corrections officer, then a Boston Police Department action called Operation Clean Sweep, which resulted in 34 arrests. Many South End residents say Operation Clean Sweep was long overdue in a neighborhood that's experiencing a rise in crime, but activists say it further stigmatized a vulnerable population and displaced many from their treatment and their community. Boston City Councilor Anissa Saibi-George is in our studios. She's the chair of the Committee on Homelessness, Mental Health, and Recovery. Councilor Saibi-George, thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, thank you for the invitation.
And also with us on the line is George Sturgios, president of the Worcester Square Area Neighborhood Association in the South End. George, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And listeners, we want to bring you in this on as well. Whether you live in the South End or not, has addiction affected your neighborhood or your town's public spaces? And what can we do about it? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or tweet us at Radio Boston. George, I want to start with you. As I just mentioned, many people in the South End felt Operation Clean Sweep was necessary, maybe even overdue. Can you give us a little bit of context in terms of what's been going on in the neighborhood?
Well, this has been certainly the worst year for us. We've had a lot of problems since, I think, 2013, when the city, without contacting us, without any sort of effort and outreach, opened up a needle exchange, one of two and by far the largest needle exchange, one block away from us on Albany Street. And since then, we've seen needles, we've seen addicts. I mean, obviously, you bring in a needle exchange, you're trying to attract addicts, and addicts are prey for dealers. So we became the open-air drug market for the city and the state, for that matter, and there's people coming from beyond the state. This is where to go for your drugs. And we've seen an increase, I think, every year. The last couple of years it seemed to plateau. This year it really increased. We've seen a major increase of people pooping on our property, peeing in our property, leaving needles, passing out. You can see people shooting up on any stoop in Worcester Square. And Worcester Square,
not just that, George, sorry to cut you off, but I just want to add that according to the Boston Globe, robberies and aggravated assaults are up 41% in the quarter mile area around the intersection of Mass Ave and Milnea Cass Boulevard. Why do you think this year there's been such a sharp uptick?
Okay, there's various explanations. One, which I think is Steve Fox from South End Forum has offered, and I mentioned to Barry Bach, who's the CEO of Healthcare for the Homeless, seemed to confirm it. Fentanyl, that let's say a couple of years ago, people were shooting heroin, and once in a while they got fentanyl instead of heroin, and they overdosed. What's happened now is people are just shooting fentanyl, and they know it's fentanyl. They still occasionally overdose, but the problem is with heroin, you have to shoot up, if you're like a full-bore addict, two or three times a day. With fentanyl, you have to shoot up every 2 hours. So you don't go, the people in the past were going to the homeless shelter, they were going to what they call the engagement center, they were able to go to facilities. They're just on the street now. They're sleeping on the street. They're hanging out on the street. They're there 24 hours a day because they can't go anywhere. They can't, you go to the homeless shelter, you have to give up your drugs. They can't wait 8 hours to shoot up again.
All right, so
that's...
Yeah, I want. That's a great point. I want to bring in Councillor Asaibi George. What do you make of that, Councillor?
Well, I think what George is seeing is certainly a response to the crisis. We have what we're dealing with here in the city of Boston is certainly that, a crisis, and it's of epic proportions here in the city. And from my perspective as chair of the Committee on Homelessness, Mental Health, and Recovery, as an elected official, city councillor, the pressure that this crisis is putting on our systems throughout our city, not just in the Mass and Cass area and the South End area, but throughout our system, our city, is really breaking the back of the work that needs to happen day in and day out. And George mentioned some changes that have happened 2013, 2014. Certainly, there's lots of reasons and excuses for this uptick to have happened in our city. The closing of the Long Island Bridge and some of the support services that were out there that were so important and critical to the well-being of lots of individuals went away. We continue to work on rebuilding the Long Island Bridge. But like George said, the change in the drugs and what we've seen since 2013 and 14 in particular is the rise in synthetic opioids and the way that their use is different than, you know, pure heroin. And that has really impacted the life and the quality of life for someone who's dealing with substance use disorders. And as a city councilor, our work is around protecting residents, protecting our neighbors and our communities, but also working to make sure that there's a high quality of life for the person who's dealing with substance use disorders.
Yeah, there really is an interesting, a challenging balance here. I want to play a cut from Jada Ricard. She's an 11-year-old student. She spoke at that community meeting last Wednesday really powerfully. I want to take a listen here.
This is not fair. Please tell me, where is my safety? We have seen people shooting up on the streets, and we have seen people having inappropriate action, and nothing has been done. And now that a correction officer has been assaulted, now you are doing something?
So, Counselor, there's, I think, a real pull and tug here about the needs and the issues that the residents are facing, and also this vulnerable population, those who are homeless or suffering from addiction. How do you balance that?
Well, it's certainly complex, as is the problem. But I would say this work, especially since I joined the council in 2016 and started to chair this newer committee, it was founded when I took office in 2016 on homelessness, mental health, and recovery. We know that there is often a very direct intersect between homelessness, between those experiencing mental health challenges and substance use disorders. So that work has to be a coordinated effort in many ways. And this, what's happened in the last few weeks, I think has elevated everyone's attention to the issue. But there have been many of us that have continued to do this work day in and day out, month after month and year after year. We just have this opportunity to elevate it to a different level of conversation for sure. But there's all of these other issues that come along with this. And, you know, I think about Operation Clean Sweep and what happened a few weeks ago. My greatest concern is the individual who has been pushed out of sort of that Mass and Cass area. Where have they ended up? What's the continuum of care for them? What are the other new impacts that our communities are facing as a certain population that is difficult, that does have complex challenges, is dealing with? How are we responding to the needs of those communities and the needs of those individuals? And that's residents, that's business owners, that's students and school children, as we heard from that young woman right there who's been very well-spoken at many of our hearings across the city.
Yeah. George, I want to bring you back in on this Operation Clean Sweep just about a week and a half ago. What did you make of the police action? Was it necessary, disruptive to the community, somewhere in between? What did you think?
Well, we had a bigger police presence for several weeks before that, basically partly because we were calling so much, 911, just reporting things. Because we, as I said, there was a sense that the police had lost control of our area. One example, which I think sums it all up, A police owner of one of the local restaurants told me about a police officer who walked out of his restaurant with a slice of pizza and found a woman shooting up, leaning back against his squad car. So there was a sense of, like, total anarchy. People were going to do whatever they're going to do. And a lot of us put pressure on the police to say, look, we cannot handle this anymore. I think a police action, a police raid, like what you saw with Operation Clean Sweep, should always be the last resort. But I think in this case, it was a last resort that was needed. I mean, there was somebody who was beaten by a number of people. And there was, again, there is a complete anarchy out there. Again, one thing other people have mentioned is that there's a greater, there's a lot more methamphetamines out there, which causes heroin. People tend not to be violent. They tend to fall down. But with methamphetamines, you're getting a lot more violence. So I think there really is a problem. The police, what they told us, is they were looking to get rid of the troublemakers. They're not looking to disperse everyone, but they're looking to get the people out of there who are dealing drugs, who are causing trouble, we know a lot of, you talk to homeless people, and they say they don't go there. They don't go to the homeless shelter anymore because they don't want to walk down that road. So it had gotten bad enough there where homeless people, addicts, mentally ill people who should be in the homeless shelter no longer want to go there because they felt it was dangerous or they're going to be tempted by drugs. Yep. So, I mean, it's a sad scene. It's a sad event when you have to bring the police in at that level. But as I said, there was a real feeling that we had lost, that the police lost complete control of the street and anything went. You could do anything anywhere.
Yeah, so there's two schools of thought on this. 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK if you want to join the conversation. We spoke with Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins on the show on Friday, and she had some concerns with the action, especially using the word sweep. There were some striking similarities between that. It happened almost at the same time as the ICE raids going on in Mississippi. Here's what she said.
You know, on the one side, we're talking about the importance of law enforcement and community having great relationships. That's what the mayor, the commissioner, and I were saying. Out of the same side of our mouths, we are sweeping people up. It's really sad. And words, you know, they called it a sweep as well. And although it's not overwhelmingly immigrants in this circumstance, it's a very similar situation, I believe.
So, Councilor Asaibi George, I want to ask you, you heard George's concerns about what's going on in the neighborhood. How do you balance and how do you create this relationship of trust and cooperation with law enforcement while at the same time not letting the situation be anarchy?
Well, it is a complex situation, and George is very vocal about the challenges that many of the residents in the South End face. But he's also articulating what many of our residents are facing across the city, because this touches everyone. There's very few people it doesn't touch. But it really speaks to the larger concerns and the larger needs. That's more recovery beds. A week ago now, I was at drug court and I met with one of our judges and some community advocates about getting individuals who are dealing with addiction into recovery. And detox isn't a problem, but for every 30 individuals who are looking for recovery, there's one bed available. That's real work that we need to do. And until we're able to help those 29 folks that are looking for a place to find sobriety, to find a lifetime of recovery, we're not going to have a handle on this situation. And it is just going to be a quick Band-Aid, a little bit of survival. The real work needs to happen. It needs to happen in partnership. And it's going to have to come at the... We have to fulfill the capacity needs across the district, across the city.
And that's a point that we heard from Mayor Walsh. We heard from Boston Police Commissioner William Gross. We heard from we spoke actually today with Suffolk County Sheriff Steve Tompkins. And everyone is talking about, yes, we need more facilities. We need more beds. How do we make that happen? I mean, that requires serious funding. Where does that come from?
Well, part of it comes from the response at the state level. Today, I held a working session to meet with my colleagues. The city council is bound by open meeting law, so we have to file an ordinance in order to meet as a group. We did that this afternoon, and we do it in partnership with the state delegation. We need them involved in this work, too, because it's not just a Boston problem, although we deal with a lot of pressures from this crisis and from this epidemic. We need recovery beds across the Commonwealth. Commonwealth. We need recovery beds across the region. We know that 60% of individuals that are appearing at our homeless shelters, not a very direct correlation, but a connected one nevertheless. We know that 60% are not from the city of Boston, and many of them are not from Massachusetts. This has to be a regional response. So it's a financial burden for all of us to bear, but we need to do it because doing it the way we are right now is more expensive in the long run financially and the human toll.
But how do you compel communities that aren't seeing this problem in their backyards to throw money into the pot to help deal with the solutions?
Well, we've asked for them to make it a part of their work in their own backyard. A lot of systems have shut down, systems of care have shut down in surrounding cities and towns, putting more and more pressure on the city of Boston. We can identify through community of origin and front door triage data where individuals are coming from. And for me, it's about getting these communities to do more of the work themselves, but also financially helping the city of Boston do some of this work because it does cost money.
But that's a tough sell. How do you convince
these
community
are their residents? I mean, it's a difficult
other than
sell,
saying please.
But it's please. But these are our brothers and sisters. These are our sons and daughters. These are our mothers and fathers. These are our next door neighbors that are all suffering from this crisis. It leaves no family untouched. And that's the piece that we need to tap into, that it's everyone's responsibility. These are our residents. These are our neighbors. These are our friends and our family. We have to do this work. And we have to work as elected officials and as advocates to compel an interest in doing this work by state lawmakers across the state and across the region.
I think most folks agree the way we're dealing with it right now is not effective enough. There have been some different out-of-the-box type solutions talked about. I want to go to a couple of callers here. Kelly from the South Shore. Kelly, welcome to Radio Boston. What's on your mind?
Hi, how are you?
Doing great. What do you think?
So I work in the addiction treatment field in a harm reduction clinic. And I just wanted to comment on, you know, what are we going to learn as a society that we can't arrest our way out of the opioid epidemic? We really need more access to treatment, access to beds. We need to open the treatment facilities on the Long Island shelters. And I also think that a supervised consumption site would greatly reduce the issues that we've been seeing in the MassAv area.
Yeah, Kelly, thanks. Kelly, thanks for the call. Ed from Medford, welcome to Radio Boston. Ed, what's on your mind?
We always, you know, act like we're the only city in the world that has this problem. What are they doing in New York? What are they doing in Los Angeles? Are they having this rise in fentanyl, which is just obscene? How are they handling these issues?
So it's an interesting question, Ed, and I can't speak specifically to New York and L.A., but, Counselor, I know you actually traveled to Canada to observe some of these consumption sites, supervised consumption sites. What did you make of what you saw?
Sure. I went last year to Vancouver, and in a few weeks I'm heading to Toronto. They have two very different models in practice. For a while, lots of the advocates had been proposing a Vancouver-like model. I went to Vancouver. I was very disappointed in what I saw. I'm hopeful that Toronto will show me something a little bit different. I am on the record opposed to safe consumption or safe injection sites, but I do think they can offer us some insight into helping individuals who are sick, who are dealing with a disease, who are dealing with addiction, find treatment, find recovery, find a lifetime of recovery, of sobriety, and I look forward to doing that. But I think it's also interesting to understand the different regional problems in the states and internationally. When we look at this drug crisis, it's the types of drugs that are appearing. So we see something a little bit different here in the Northeast, and we are preparing for this next wave, this change in drugs and the way that they're mixed, sort of the cocktails that are created on the street. And how do we respond as a city, as a health commission, as public health providers? How are we responding to that change in drugs? And they see something a little bit different on the West Coast, something different in the South.
Yeah. I want to bring George Sergios back in here from the Worcester Square Area Neighborhood Association. George, what do you make of this concept of supervised consumption sites?
You know, what I think is striking is Canada started its first safe injection site, I think, in 2003. But in 1963, it started allowing methadone to be prescribed by doctors. Not everything methadone has to be clinic-based now, which means There's 1,300 people every day who drive to the South End from all over the state to get their methadone. Some of them get in trouble afterwards. They get their methadone, they start mixing other drugs, mixing with people, getting themselves in trouble. Most of them go back to work or go to work or go back to their homes. So I think that Canada for 40 years was prescribing methadone out of pharmacies. You could pick that up at a pharmacy or at a doctor's office. The same with Australia. 30 years before they opened their first Sage injection site, they had methadone prescribed from doctor's offices or from pharmacies. That's the same case with Germany. 10 years before they opened their first safe injection facility, they were prescribing methadone. I think this is a huge key. That if you let people, the first most important thing is most of the people who are addicted want to get off. The easiest way to get off, to get sober, is through medically assisted treatment, whether it's methadone or Suboxone. We should be concentrating on that 90% who want to be sober, who want to be sober. Once we clean that up, once we've taken care of those people, then we should concentrate on that 5 or 10% who are going to shoot up for the rest of their lives for whatever psychological, mental reasons.
All right. Sorry to cut you there, George, but that's George Sturgios, president of the Worcester Square Area Neighborhood Association in the South End. George, thanks so much for the time.
You're welcome.
And also with us, Boston City Councilor Anissa Saibi. George, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Chris Sidorek. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.